702.
Weekend Breakfast with Refilwe Mbakanyane.
Let's walk the talk.
It's 9:40 on the Saturday edition of Weekend Breakfast. Thanks so much for tuning in. Welcome to it if you've just joined us. We're in the final stretch, the last 20 minutes of Weekend Breakfast. And sure, my goodness, I've been anticipating and looking forward to this author interview for a long while. And really excited to welcome Tendai Uchu to Weekend Breakfast. His latest book is The Library of the Dead. You might have come across or met Tendai through his other books, The Hairdresser of Harare being one of them. The second one is The Maestro, The Magistrate and The Mathematician. And I could go on, but let's focus on The Library of the Dead and the fact that it's an absolute gem and well worth your time. Tendai Uchu, welcome to Weekend Breakfast. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Rafila. Good morning from a sunny Edinburgh.
A sunny Edinburgh. My goodness, it must. Everyone has probably come out soaking up the rays and making the most of such a day. Tendai, can I just tell you that upon finishing Library of the Dead, which is the first installment, the first of a trilogy, if I remember correctly, yes, book one, I read Library of the Dead and for about a week, I think that I had something that I had to go back to or something that I needed to, you know, resume, or there was something I'd forgotten. And I realized that it was this itch to get back to this book and to hang out more with the protagonist, Rupa Moyo, and to hang out a little bit more with Rupa's little sister and Rupa's granny as well. And only for it to hit me once again that, oh no, you finished the book. There's nothing more, at least in this installment.
You are very, very kind, Rafilwe. That is the sort of feedback any author would die for. You know, I wrote the book sort of like a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. As you've indicated, I'd done mainstream fiction with my first two novels, but I wanted to move into genre fiction, sci-fi and fantasy, and I was doing like a lot of short stories. Yes. Before I wrote The Library of the Dead. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of years ago, I did a short story called Ghost Stoker, which was set in my hometown of Bindura in Zimbabwe, which sure. is like a small mining town, 70 kilometers north of Harare. Mm-hmm. But I liked the character, and the character stayed with me. That was sort of like the prototype for Rupa Moyo.
Yes.
But I needed to do the story on a larger canvas when it came to doing the novel. And that's why I shifted that over to Edinburgh,
yeah,
where I've lived and worked for the last 16 odd years. Mm. So it's a place I'm very familiar with.
Yeah.
And Edinburgh isn't the biggest city in the world. But what you get with living here is the history, the historical dimension. So there's a lot of history in that novel. So you've got a small space with a large history, and the history fills in the special aspects that I let in the story. And ghosts, I mean, Edinburgh is full of ghosts. I told you this morning is nice and sunny, but trust me, when the temperature hits 13 degrees Celsius,
sure,
we take off our shirts and we go, oh my God, this is amazing. You know? But most of the time, it is gray and gloomy and spooky. You walk through the old town of Edinburgh, sort of like the historic part at night.
Yeah.
And there's always a shadow, something moving in the corner of your eye, something a little bit spooky. So it's a great place to be writing about little girls who talks to ghosts for a living.
Well, to that point, Tendai, all of that comes through so amazingly well and so beautifully in the novel. And I think this is a fantastic time to just read the blurb about the blurb on the back of the book and just give everyone a sense of what the Library of the Dead is. And here it goes. It says, Rupa dropped out of school to become a ghost talker, and they sure do love to talk. Now she speaks to Edinburgh's dead, carrying messages to those they left behind. A girl's got to earn a living, and it seems harmless enough. Until, that is, the dead whisper that someone's bewitching children, leaving them husks empty of joy. It's on Roper's patch that so she feels honor-bound to investigate. But what she learns will rock her world. Roper will dice with death as she calls on Zimbabwean magic and Scottish pragmatism to hunt down clues. And although underground Edinburgh hides a wealth of dark secrets, she also discovers an occult library and some unexpected allies. Yet as shadows lengthen, will the hunter become the hunted? Let me tell you, Tendai, that spookiness, the sense of history that you talk about, you've invoked so incredibly well. But, you know, Roper is a hard-boiled, determined, dutiful sister and granddaughter living in dystopian Edinburgh, sending messages between the dead and their families to make a living. Because it's not an act of service that she does. It's an actual business, right? So she'll only pass on messages if perhaps these ghosts have got relatives who are able to pay her in return for having these messages couriered to them. So it's very pragmatic. She's very hard-nosed in that sense. But my goodness, she is the ultimate protagonist, the ultimate hero in the story, because what she won't sacrifice for the people that she cares about and loves. What a lovely character. What a beautiful character Rupa is.
Thank you. I'll start off just with the magic. Think about it. If magic was part of the real world that we live in today, it would kind of be mundane, right? Because you don't go out in the streets and look at a car and go, wow, the wonders of the internal combustion engine. It's just there, right? The internet.
Absolutely.
All these wonderful things are just there and we take them for granted. Mm. But one thing that is guaranteed that we would do if magic was real is we would monetize it, because we monetize everything,
yes,
right? Those TikTok dances the kids do, whatever sort of like art or craft you can think of is monetized, it's business. And Roper realizes this. That's why she delivers these messages from the dead for a living, for money. That's all she's interested in. Because at 14, she's also having to take care of a blind grandma and put her little sister through school. Now, you've quite rightly pointed out that the Edinburgh she lives in has been described as dystopian. But what most people don't realize is the trick that I did was I just turned Edinburgh into a third world city, right? So it's only dystopian in the sense Harare or New Delhi or Sao Paulo are dystopian cities.
Yeah.
Because it's cities where certain things work, the power supply might be intermittent, you know, the traffic lights or the robots, whichever term you prefer, may or may not work, and small things like that. So for a lot of readers, it's been disorientating seeing Edinburgh in that light, right? But if you go back in history, and this is why the history is so important to me, 300 years ago, Edinburgh was the poorest nation in Western Europe. You know, if President Trump was still in office, he would have called it something very unsavory.
An S-hole country,
There we go. I wasn't going to say that live on radio.
Sure.
So when you really know the history of the city, what you see is the Edinburgh depicted now in my book, which is set slightly into the future, is actually an Edinburgh that is much like that historical Edinburgh that had slums and was dirty and smelly and stinky. So the story I'm telling in the future is almost like the history has come back full circle, because Scotland really takes off and becomes a wealthy nation once it joins the union with England. England was building an empire around the world, you know, and sort of like plundering resources from other countries. And once Scotland joins the union in 1707, it then has the resources to build this sort of like modern, wonderful place that I live in. So this book is almost saying history has come full circle. The honeymoon is over.
It's over. You know, that's such an interesting... Okay, Ron?
No, I was just going to say, but all this is told through Roper, who's a really young, sort of like slangy, fight, irreverent character.
Mm.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that device. I enjoyed that trick. As you say, the dystopian is actually not, is actually historical. I enjoyed also the mystery of not quite understanding just how it is that, you know, the magic is so widely accepted and every day in Edinburgh. We're not quite sure if it's, you know, all come about through, you mentioned colonial conquest, right? How did magic come to Edinburgh's shores and Scotland's shores? We know, for instance, that Roper's grandmother came to Scotland for university, right? She went there for uni, but it's these worlds, these countries that have melded somewhere somehow, and we're not quite sure in the first book of how it's come about. And I wonder if you'll ever tell us in the rest of Rupa Moyer's story. But at any rate, the mystery of it is just so gripping, and in a strange sense, I almost didn't feel the need to get answers to that. Of how that came about. It was enough just to see Rupa in action dealing with the day-to-day stresses and pressures of, you know, being talking to ghosts in this strange setting, you know. How do you, I guess, Karen, didn't I?
You read it so well, because all these things are going to come into play eventually. That history, I mean, when we just talk about the magic system, which is one of the most interesting things for a writer working in fantasy, how to sort of like create your magic system. And this magic system is also linked to Scottish history. So you are aware that there's different types of magic. Roper practices a sort of like Zimbabwean magic where she plays Zambira instruments in order to commune with ghosts, which sort of like in traditional Shona religion, that's how you would sort of like, you'd have your drums and your Zambira and do these ceremonies to get in touch with the ancestors.
Yes.
And she's doing it in Edinburgh. But the Scottish magical system is called scientific magic, which in itself is an oxymoron, right? Mm. Either something is magical or scientific, but they've kind of managed to meld the two together.
Yeah.
And the only reason I had it as that is I was wandering through Edinburgh trying to find a great setting for my Library of the Dead. And I wanted to have it under Carlton Hill, which is in the town center. Mm-hmm. So I was walking through the old sort of like, there's this ancient graveyard in the city, looking for an entrance point to the Library of the Dead. And there was this beautiful mausoleum. It was round, you know, it was proper Gothic.
Yeah.
That I wanted to use as the entrance point. And that is the final resting place of David Hume, the Enlightenment philosopher. If you think about concepts like skepticism or empiricism, and that Hume cast a long shadow in Scottish sort of like intellectual history.
Yes.
So automatically then I called the Society of Magicians the Society of Skeptical Inquirers, and they took on a scientific bent.
Yeah.
And the monetization is also supported by Hume's best friend was Adam Smith, the economist. All these concepts, what you're seeing in the magic and sort of like in the social practices, actually comes from that history that we're talking about earlier.
Yeah. It's really, really fascinating. Yeah. The professionalization of magic, right, is quite an interesting concept. And something that comes through in many ways, and I won't drop a spoiler over here, but Rupa and her gran, who's incredibly supportive of her and who's, the adult in their lives, but who Rupa has to help look after, are huge fans. They're both huge fans of a TV presenter called Siobhan. And she's essentially of the same generation as Rupa's grandmother, except Rupa describes her as somehow looking 20 years younger. She's elegant. She's breathtaking. She's got an old person's RP accent. And Rupa says, and the longer the show goes on, the younger she seems, maybe getting some body work herself, alluding to the kind of show that Siobhan is running. A critique there of celebrity culture, of the sort of adoration or adulation that strangers receive just by virtue of being on a, you know, on TV or a large platform.
Definitely. Literature, wherever it's set, it always reflects the world that we live in now, and celebrity culture is a big thing. Mm. But one of the themes of the book is also how we are plundering this world and pretty much destroying it for the next generation. So youth is a commodity. Mm. We're pretty much, you know, the central problem is missing children, children who are having their youth sucked out of them. And that I use as a metaphor for how we're destroying this planet, and the next generations probably won't have it as good as we do. Mm.
Yeah, quite literally sucking the life out of young people and the life out of their future as well. You know, Tendai, I think when what you alluded to is creating magic systems and the kinds of, you know, how you have to apply yourself when writing genre fiction, as you did in this instance. And what I loved was the way, the language that you came up with, the words, the vocabulary, you know, as any good self-respecting genre fiction writer does, we read it and right away we know exactly what you're talking about. We don't have to look twice, thrice and try to like read it in context. We just know the every there, for instance, being the afterlife. How many phrases, words did you try on for ghosts, which Rupa refers to as deados, you know, how many phrases or iterations did you go through? Because it has to just land seamlessly for the reader. And it does, which is what makes us such a beautiful read and a seamless read. What is the process for you as the writer, the creator of this book?
I mean, language is so important, particularly when you have a character like Rupa who has a very strong voice.
Yeah.
Now, it's set in Edinburgh, and people in Edinburgh don't speak the same way as people in London do. So they use quite a bit of Scots, which, you know, is its own language, but you find sort of like all these words, like instead of saying don't, they say dinny and things like that.
Sure.
So the language in the novel, it mixes up quite a bit of Scots, a tiny amount of Shona, a lot of slang. Rupa uses a lot of slang words, both sort of like Americanized slang and Scots slang. Mm-hmm. And then because it's set in an alternate world, there are these made-up concepts like the everyday, you know, and these little terms that kind of give you a sense that this is a slightly different world. I think for a novelist, if you don't get the language right, you can maintain the same story, but the reader won't have that feel of being immersed in a very different sort of like place.
Mm. Yeah.
And so I do a lot of work and a lot of revision just to get the language right.
Yeah. The excitement of seeing just, I guess, your Shona heritage, culture, derivatives thereof, you know, in this lovely work of of dystopian fiction or speculative fiction, or you know, it was just really, really wonderful. I read somewhere that you also did derive a bit of the DNA or some inspiration of this book from the writer Ben Aronovich, who of course is a friend of yours. So on the cover of the book, he has quite enthusiastically endorsed the book, saying beautifully written. What were those elements that you melded or, you know, gleaned inspiration from?
Well, that insulates me from a lawsuit. In case he ever wants to sue me for plagiarism in the future, I can say you endorsed this.
He wouldn't dare.
But, I mean, The Rivers of London, which Ben Aronovich does, is a marvelous series. I think it's being adapted for television. I heard it's been optioned for that. And it's this police procedural set in London. Mm-hmm. Which is about Peter Grant, who's like a young rookie cop who gets involved in this magical underworld. But the book still has a lot of like your routine police procedural stuff, like they do a lot of paperwork.
Yeah.
And it isn't really a glamorous magical world like we've come to expect in fiction.
Yeah.
And those elements of kind of like grounding magic into a realistic setting is what I did for the Library of the Dead. Albeit, I think my creation is far superior.
And on that note, what self-aggrandizing note, but you know what? You are well within your rights to do so.
The hubris.
Kendai, thank you so much for such a beautiful book, for something that was a welcome respite during this COVID-19 and lockdown period. But even now, that I think will just like stand us in such good stead in the future. I'm looking forward to the next installment and the next installment after that. I found a huge, huge friend, a lifelong friend in your character, Ropa Moyo. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens in her new adventures.
Thank you so much, Rafael. Next spring, you will get Our Lady of Mysterious Ailments, the second book in the series.
It's a date. That's Tia Huchu, the writer of Library of the Dead.